When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Alan, please take a seat on my Homo sapiens couch.
I'm here. I'm fluffing the cushion right next to you in the virtual cushion. Very excited about today's interviewee, Christopher.
I love Jameela Jamil, a British actress, but also activist.
Oh, so many things. Activist, writer.
And she was a T4 host in the UK, which is like a kind of, it was like a music show in the UK.
Music, youthy show on Channel 4.
Yeah, a bit youth. And she has sort of reinvented herself in LA as this kind of amazing activist who has set up a thing called I Way, which is a brilliant Instagram account, but is kind of, I'm going to say movement, about trying to reclaim some of the kind of rubbish ideas that are rammed down women's throats by mainstream media.
Especially for young girls.
Yeah.
And also she, you know, in terms of she went to America to sort of have a change, wanted to do some writing, and immediately got offered a part in this sitcom that ran for years called...
The Good Place.
Good Place, Good Place. And so that's, many people I'm sure will know her from that mostly, yeah. But she's, that was a total accident. I love that. I love people whose lives just go, you know, completely in the opposite direction. And she's just really fascinating, I think. And also I think what was great about this interview is that she talked very openly and candidly about some of the kind of altercations that she had with the press recently, and perhaps one and very freely about the fact that she had mishandled the whole situation when she talked about being queer and about the timing of that. So it's really interesting. I love when we get down to it with someone and they are, feel confident and open enough to just really not be guarded about sensitive things. And this is what made this such a great chat for me.
I agree. And one of the things that she says, which is a breath of fresh air, is that she sort of started her own I Way podcast, for example, is that so that she could learn with her listeners, because there's a lot of uncharted waters at the moment of people learning about huge things like systemic racism, or learning about huge things like beyond the gender binary. And we're all learning and we're trying to get it right and we're going to get it wrong, and that's okay. And she says, you know, I'm going to make mistakes. And I think that people with that level of humility
Totally
are just my favorite types. And she's so generous.
She's such a nice girl, and I mean just a charmer in all ways, and also hilarious as well. Hilarious. So let's hear it for Jameela Jamil.
How come you don't have a microphone?
I've got these little futuristic ones that are stuck inside my ear.
Look at you, the technology. You're like Star Trek.
Yeah, I'm exactly like Star Trek.
Uhura,
exactly.
Uhura.
The
I actually met the lady who was Uhura in one of those comic things. There was a hobbit next to me. Chewbacca was there. Uhura was there. It was just crazy. And it was literally in a shopping mall in Milton Keynes.
I've had some great DJ gigs in Milton Keynes.
Have you?
Yeah, they have like, I think I did a Young Farmers Ball there.
Oh my
God. Where I
would
DJ for Young Farmers students. And there were, I think, I'm not sure if that was the city, but I'm pretty sure at least one of those gigs, 6,000 people were dressed as Where's Wally? Where's Waldo?
I love that.
Where's Waldo?
And so all I could see was pissed teenagers who couldn't find each other because it was just a sea of people dressed identically. And so everyone was lost and sad and alone, and I was DJing.
Hilarious.
Going back to the Farmers Ball, what was that?
The Young Farmers.
Yeah, the Young Farmers Ball. So they don't get...
Yeah, I remember that as a thing.
It was huge, and it was truly like somewhere always between 6,000 and 10,000 people. and it was this massive event, and it's because they don't get their Saturdays and Sundays because they're out farming and selling to us so that we can eat breakfast. And so therefore they do these young farmers balls every couple of months, which is kind of like their New Year's Eve, because they finally get to go out and feel what it's like on Friday night. And so I used to do those of a Tuesday.
Young farmers balls. There's an image.
Well, there's a whole gay agriculture movement in the UK, actually.
Is there? This is a whole new subculture I didn't think I was going
to
be.
This is what we got you here to talk about, Jamila, just so you know.
I'm ready. I've DJed for them all.
Where are you? Where are you talking to us from? LA?
I'm in LA. Yeah, I love Los Angeles. Does that make me a bad person? It makes me a bad Brit. I know that.
No, no, it doesn't. I was listening to something you'd said. I really sort of understood what you meant when you said about how, you know, the sort of the madness or the kind of the chaos of London, and how when you go to LA that there's just this sort of, I mean, it's crazy and chaotic, but there's calmness. You can have a calm life there that is impossible to have, I think, in other big cities.
In Los Angeles, because it's so spread out and everyone's so far apart, you have to seek out the madness. Whereas in London or in New York, it's thrust up your ass. And so it's just like you've got someone's armpit in your face first thing in the morning, but then you've got no space. And then you live in an apartment where you don't get much for what you're paying for. And it's just like, it's a stressful, very fun and exhilarating, but very stressful culture. And I think that because of that, you can miss certain things that are making you feel like shit because you are able to blame your external surroundings. Whereas with Los Angeles, because everything's like sunny, the food's amazing, you have loads of space, money goes so much further here when it comes to like property or whatever, that I didn't have anything I could blame my sadness on. And so it forced me to confront all of my own issues, which I thought was really great.
Were you sad when you went there?
I was still a bit sad. I had a hangover of sadness. I was definitely much better, but I'd only had a couple of months of therapy before I got here. But I was definitely still a bit sad. And also, you know, it's lonely when you get here. You don't know anyone.
Yes.
It's not pedestrian. You don't walk around and see people and bump into friends. You have to really make a definitive plan. So you don't know anyone.
Yes. Why were you sad when you said you were at a hangover of sadness? What was the sadness from?
I've suffered with mental health issues my whole life. And I think I kind of hit the epicenter of it all when I was about 26 and had a nervous breakdown and didn't still go to therapy for another 2 years, just sort of tried to figure my life out myself practically, because I had that sort of classic stupid British shame around getting therapy or going on medication, etc. You know, I had all of the stigmas, and so I was like, no, I'm going to do this practically, and that was hugely effective, and I made loads of massive changes in my life. I kind of went on what I describe as a fuck shit detox, where I just got rid of all of the fuck shit from my life, people and things and schedules that were making me worse, and started confronting all my trauma. But I did it without help. And I didn't really start to get help until about 2 months before I left for Los Angeles.
Right.
So I was still kind of, you know, when you have therapy, it's hugely helpful, but it also brings a lot up to the surface. And so I think I brought some of that debris with me in my luggage to Los Angeles. But it was great because I'd no longer, it was when you have a plain land to look across, as in like when everything is smooth sailing, it really makes it easy for you to identify your sources of pain and trauma. And so therefore I was able to recover so much quicker here than I would have somewhere else where I might have been more distracted.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. And what were you doing in your life at the time when this all happened? Were you having to work and be presented to the world and everything whilst you were kind of crumbling inside?
Yeah, I was sort of like at the height of my career in the UK, and I was hosting all these shows, and I was a BBC broadcaster, and I had all these clothing lines out, and I was just, I had become full public property in the UK in a way that was becoming quite abusive, and the paparazzi were just practically sleeping outside my house. So all day, all night, for about 6 months straight, being incredibly vile about the way that I look or saying very sexual comments to me, just harassing me. And so I think if you are already going through your own mental health issues, fame is probably one of the worst. It's just throwing fuel on the fire. And then the paparazzi are just like the harassment that comes with it just means you can't go out. You can't see friends. You can't go for the walk. You can't go out and exercise. You just end up staying in your house. So I kind of became just quite agoraphobic, suicidal, depressed. And it was so funny because on the outside, it was projected that I was, you know, I had so much privilege, but on the outside, it looked like I was this happy party girl. Whereas inside I was truly dying. And so I just made a big change. And one of those changes included getting out of London and moving to a place where I would be fairly anonymous, where even with my career taking off the way it has, I'm still fairly anonymous because no one cares who I am. Everyone thinks I'm Riz Ahmed here. No one knows if I am or I'm not Riz Ahmed. Like Jack Nicholson is like standing at the aisle, like I froze down. People care about him. Right. Not me.
He takes the heat off. Do you remember the moment when, because I, you know, I watched your career from the very beginning and, you know, you've had many iterations. And do you, one thing I want to ask you is, do you remember the moment that you chose to start speaking out publicly against stuff and what galvanized you to do that? Because you'd had some horrible experiences, but a lot of people don't speak out.
So there were kind of two stages. The first stage is that year one of my career, I was given a column in a magazine and they wanted it to be a fashion column. And within 1 week, I changed it to a social commentary column. So I was just like, I don't know anything about fashion. I've only just discovered Topshop. I'm like, come from a poor background. I don't know what Mugler is like or Dolce & Gabbana. Please don't try and force me to be Alexa Chung. She is doing what she's doing and she does it very well. And I'm a completely different person and type. And so I pushed and pushed and pushed to be able to make a social commentary. And I started opening up there. And so that was the first time I started to just start telling all of my truth. And it was received well. And so I kind of built my confidence up to start using all of my interviews to talk about social justice. And then the moment where I became diehard, that's it, this is all I'm going to talk about, was when I was 26, in that breakdown year, I'd had pneumonia for a really long time. So they'd given me loads of steroids. I gained a huge amount of weight, but I was also a radio DJ at the time. So it didn't make sense to me as to why I would be harassed this much for gaining weight when you can't see me at my job. You know, is patriarchy around, our society is so obsessed with female thinness and smallness that they just need to know I'm thin over the airwaves. Yeah. You just need to sit safely in the knowledge that a thin person is telling you
about
music. You
weren't sounding thin. That was the problem, was it?
Yeah. I remember saying at the time, I was like, unless I am fat to the point where I can't open my mouth anymore, this does not impact my career. And so that just pissed me off.
Maybe I just eat, like me eating, I get told off for eating.
Yeah, Alan's experienced a lot of shaming for eating on this podcast, as have I. So maybe that was what it was.
I'm really intrigued about you talking about this the nervous breakdown, because my sort of understanding, my narrative of you was that you had the you find a lump in your breast, and when you're waiting for that, you decided, oh, I'm going to move to California, and that was what did it. But is that not true? Is it the nervous breakdown that was sort of
more
of a catalyst?
I'd already had so I created the list of all the things I wanted to do. I called it my fuck it list, and I created that at 26, and at the top of that list was move to America. But I still didn't have the nerve to do it, because I kept being fear-mongered, you know, like, especially as a woman of color, like, you're told all the time that you have a sprint, not a marathon in this industry, and someone's going to take your place. And I kept on being like definitively reassured by my peers, by everyone I knew and trusted, that if I moved to America, I would disappear and I would never find work ever again and never get a visa and become homeless and throw it all away. So I was being so consistently fear-mongered, with other people projecting their own insecurities about themselves onto me, that I was weighed down in it. And I think there was just something about finding
who were these people?
Everyone around me. And I think it came from a place of like what they thought was love. And I understand it as well. Like, if your mentally ill friend says, I'm moving to America to start again,
right,
in an industry that is,
who sounds not thin as well.
Yeah. Who isn't skinny, who isn't young in Hollywood terms for a woman,
right,
you know, pushing 28, pushing 30, and
yeah,
who is completely unknown there. I do also understand that. And it's also, you know, it's not the easiest place for a South Asian to break out. We don't have many still. You can count us on one hand. So I do understand it, but it was also just such intense fear-mongering and like just such doom around it. And so I believed that for a while, but there was something about finding out that I didn't have cancer. I wasn't going to lose my breasts, as so many women in my family have or who have died. And I was like, right, well, you know what? This is now or never. And this might come back one day. And I don't want to sit here just worrying about my fucking career. I need get out of here. And so I booked my ticket 6 weeks to the day from the operation, and to have the lump removed, and then that was it. I was off and away. And it was great.
Wow.
Incredible.
But that was the thing that tipped me over the edge. It was always something that was in the back of my mind.
Hmm. Going back to the nervous breakdown. Sorry, I'm as a nervous breakdown survivor myself.
Connoisseur,
yes. A nervy bee, I called mine. I'm really intrigued about, was it something, was it about stuff that, was it just the kind of, you know, societal pressure of stuff that you were finding? Or was it from, for me, it was very much about stuff from the past that I hadn't realized and hadn't processed. What was the sort of, what were the ingredients of your nervous breakdown, if we can make a cooking allusion?
Oh, no, for sure. Okay, so I had an incredibly tricky childhood, came up with no money and my parents had a really, really difficult and traumatic marriage. And I don't want to go further into that because that's their business to tell, not mine. And just grew up with a lot of mentally ill people. I would say every single member of my family was severely mentally ill. And these were issues that were to, you know, either severe eating disorders or bipolar or schizophrenia or, you know, severe manic depression, anxiety. So I was becoming a carer by the time I was about 9 years old for a lot of adults around me. So I was just like soaked in trauma. And then bullied at school and then developed my own eating disorder as my method of control and finding worth in this world. Because it was the years of heroin chic. So I was just, it was just every type of abuse that I had experienced. So whether that was physical or emotional or sexual, it had all happened to me. And I think that you are able to bottle it up only for so long as a human being. And it is traditionally around in your approach to your 30s that you start to come undone. Like it's only so far you can push it down. And I think I was probably pushing it down with food in my 26th year, where I was just trying to keep everything down so I could maintain this like happy, funny persona that I had on television. And I imploded as was going to happen.
It's a bit like water, isn't it? It always finds its way out somehow.
Yeah. And so I just sort of burst with trauma and, you know, I wasn't sleeping properly and I massively, massively attribute my ridiculous decision to try and take my own life to the fact that I was so sleep deprived that I wasn't thinking straight. And that's why I'm so open about it now, just to explain to people that there is a life beyond that terrible day or that terrible moment where you make this decision that you can't take back. And so I beg people just to hang on, because things can get better, and they did get better for me. And that's why I choose to be so vocal about it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But I was just miserable. I was having nightmares. I was sleep deprived and I was famous and unable to express myself. I was being so scrutinized, so punished for just existing as a woman in media, because the media really is just so cruel to women in a way, in England in particular, in a way that is just like, it's remarkable. It's not even just insidious. It's insidious and blatant at the same time. And then I also had this stigma around talking about mental health, reaching out to anyone, getting therapy, going on medication. So it was remarkable I survived that year, but I'm glad I did.
Were you on your own then?
Yeah.
Gosh, poor darling. That sounds absolutely awful. I'm so sorry.
It was a tricky time, and I'd cut my, you know, entire family off at that time as well. So I truly had zero support network, wasn't talking to my friends, nothing. Wow. Just alone, eating roast chickens, like full roast chickens in my bed. with the world outside thinking that I was living my best life.
That you're like this socialite, swanky, fun-loving girl about town. And you're eating roast chicken with your hands in bed.
Alone.
Hilarious. That's showbiz.
I think so.
If we, you know, like fast forward to now, and you've created this incredible community with Ai Weiwei and with your own like personal Instagram, the whole community as well. You know, they're two slightly separate things. But what would you say to that person who's sitting in bed eating the chicken?
Get some fucking therapy. Go to therapy. Stop being an idiot. Don't listen to English people and go to therapy. Because I would have, you know, saved myself a lot of money and a lot of trouble if I had just sorted myself out way before then. I mean, we should be introducing the conversations around mental health in school, around eating disorders, around consent, around abuse. So we should be, I didn't need to learn about igneous rock. I've never once had to fucking identify a fucking igneous rock in school.
Or the tundra. I just always like, so much of this about the fucking tundra I got.
Tectonic plates.
Truly fuck a Bunsen burner. Like, give me a lighter. Like, why do I know all about that, but I don't know anything about the most important things that are going to, my humanity is going to rely upon? So just to quickly seal that up, at 26, when I was getting fat shamed, the first time I was like, okay, you know what, fuck you. I'm not going to be obedient. I'm not going to lose weight. I'm not going to get a trainer. I'm going to stay fat for as long as I fucking feel like I can. And I'm going to fight back. And I started speaking at Parliament and I became like incredibly diehard, which is why what's frustrating, because I think we're about to jump over to where I'm at now. It's so funny to me that people think that I've only been talking about this since 2 years into my part as Tahani in The Good Place. They think I discovered activism 2 years ago, whereas I've been an activist since I was 19. I'd say now, because I live in so much privilege, it almost feels awkward to call myself an activist, maybe more of an advocate, because activists really are grassroots. But I've been saying all the same stuff publicly for about 10 years.
Just people are listening now.
Yeah, people are acting, A, like I've never said this before, but they're acting like no one's ever said this before, whereas there have been 40 years of amazing advocates and activists who've been saying all this shit all along, but we only listen to the privileged. And even then, we only do it for a certain amount of time. We don't listen to the marginalized. We blame them for their marginalization. And then we listen to the privileged briefly, and then after, very quickly say to them, well, you're privileged, so you don't get to speak out on this. So therefore, whoever gets to have this difficult conversation?
So true.
I wanted to ask you more about your background and in terms of all these things you're talking about stigma of various kinds, how much that was compounded by growing up in a Southern Asian community.
Massively, massively. Yeah, I can't just blame the Brits. Like, also, we have so much shame around mental health, and really, truly, like, the end goal for all of my lineage anyway was just, you have to go to Cambridge. You have to go to Cambridge, Oxford, and you have to be a really successful doctor or lawyer, and that's it. And so it was every stereotype in the book, at least within my own experience of my, you know, the people around me. And so, yeah, that was a big part of it as well. And I think, you know, and also I always saw the mental health issues in my family result in them being sectioned. You know, members of my family being sectioned very aggressively or having their stomachs pumped in front of me. It was so... the version of it that I saw was so traumatic. It wasn't, oh, mum is sad or dad is sad, or many people will see a family member go through a struggle and just go to get help and it's fairly calm and, you know, there'll be slight bumps in the road. Whereas what I just saw was like a Nicolas Cage movie. It just all felt like the inside.
Good reference.
It was chaos. I grew up in chaos. So I associated mental health issues with utter chaos, whereas actually it's not. It's quite mundane a lot of the time.
Yes, and everywhere. And what about the queer thing? Because I saw recently you said that you defined as queer, and that must be difficult within that community too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I didn't say anything for so long. And I was going to never say anything, and then I chose truly the most inappropriate moment possible to do it. But I am a human.
Why? Because of the show that...
Yeah, but it was... I got cast on a show that centres the ballroom community, which is predominantly LGBTQ people of colour, especially Black and Latinx people. And so I was brought on to judge because I think the entire cast of Pose was busy. Genuinely, that's literally what happened. The entire cast of... And I think Billy Porter was supposed to take my role originally. And they needed someone who had a big enough platform to guarantee viewers, advertising and press, etc. And so I think that was their decision to include two cis women, which is myself and the rapper Megan Thee Stallion, because we were allies and advocates, and we wanted to make sure our communities paid homage and experienced this incredible community that pop culture steals so much from but never discusses. You know, so no one knows about the ballroom community or voguing or the fact that everything we see in fashion, art, music, vernacular, all of it, dance, comes originally from ballroom, but they never get the money or recognition. Mm. Big pop stars who steal from them but don't credit them do. Mm-hmm. So we had but we had the best of intentions signing on. But I think I understand that people were upset.
Sorry, it's my dog barking.
That's all right. The dog is upset still that I got the role on Legendary.
he's holding a petition.
But did you feel you had to, it was as a reaction to people being upset that you felt you had to be more vocal about your, how you defined yourself sexually?
Yeah, I think people were just like, why would you even care? Like, you're just, you don't care about this community at all. You're just doing this for fame, etc. And I was like, I wanted to explain that the reason I'm doing this is because my love for ballroom and for representation and for just honoring this community comes from the fact that I've been a silent member of this community, a secret member of this community my whole life. And I've looked to them and looked towards them and been inspired by them and wanted to join them in a more open way outside of just my private circle, but felt too afraid to because of my background, because of being South Asian.
Well, it's funny because it's something that we hear a lot, and like Alan and I have spoken about a lot, because, you know, Alan identifies as bisexual, for example, and a lot of, I've heard people say over time that people who identify as bisexual or pansexual or many things sometimes have said to me that they chose the easier path, because if they fancy men and women and it's the straight version is to fancy women, then they'll just do that, because then they don't have to address other difficult things within their life. Was there any element of that for you?
No, I was just telling the truth. I just shouldn't have done it then, because it looked like I was trying to deflect, whereas I wasn't. I was just trying to explain. Mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to make the conversation now about my sexuality. I was just explaining that, oh, I'm not this like straight person trying to steal from this girl. I actually have a deep, long, lifelong love and desire to make sure that we are represented, and this is where that love comes from, and this is something that I'm going through personally.
Right, but I guess the people who gave you the job didn't know that initially, did they? They didn't come to you with that knowledge.
No, they didn't. No, they came to me as,
so maybe the
just purely
criticism is based on their mercenary nature of what
they came. I mean, they didn't. I mean, Megan Thee Stallion, I believe she's straight. I don't think that was something that was, I don't think it was reliant upon that, because the ballroom community has always had a history of including cis or straight or non-ballroom people. You know, so yes. Naomi Campbell coming to like judge a ball, etc. So that, because there is a history of, in particular, celebrities coming and like sponsoring a ball or judging a ball, I think they didn't think that it would be this much of an issue. It wasn't reliant upon my sexuality. It's reliant on whether or not I could bring numbers to the table. And also, they came to me after 2 years of making this show. So I reckon they must have gone to other people first who said no, because maybe they weren't willing to take a chance on this fucking incredible show and community. So I'm thrilled we made it, and it was a huge success, which is really exciting. And we're coming back for a second season, and the contestants are so happy, and I think it might be genuinely one of the best dance competitions or competitions on the television. So it worked out. It was just, it was a bit messy at first.
And how did it affect you? Like, we're talking about your mental health, and how did it affect you having all that sort of, having to talk openly about something and then being kind of facing a barrage of, well, I don't know if it was criticism, but what would
it be?
There's
people saying that I'm in a straight relationship currently, so therefore I'm lying, which is,
well, that's
a fundamental,
that's just ignorant
ignorance
and dopey. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the biggest problem.
I don't mean that. I mean, just like, you know, like you've just basically come out, and you've come out in an arena where you're being either criticized or suspected.
Gaslit.
Or something. Not for the whatever, or maybe even of the timing of it. I just wonder what that was like for you. I mean, it's a big sort of that moment when people sort of are, who have perhaps come from backgrounds where they haven't been able to be open about their sexuality completely, when they do it, it's like supposed to be a celebratory moment. And it obviously wasn't really for you, was it?
No, I mean, definitely wasn't. I wasn't planning on it being celebratory. Like, I didn't really plan on talking about it publicly, also because of the fact that I was worried that people would think, regardless, that I'm doing it to be trendy. That's why I hadn't come out until then, was because I didn't want, A, I was afraid of, like, my community's reaction. I was also worried about whether or not
community,
that
impacts
my, as in the South Asian community, I was worried about how that would be received. Right. I had internalized shame around that. But also, by the time I'd let go of that shame, I was also becoming a very public figure, and I didn't want to look like I was trying to wear that as a hat to look, you know, extra woke, or to get extra woke points, or to, you know what I mean? Like, to look, to be trendy, to be considered like trendy, and to be on the, you know, the cover of Out magazine, etc. Like, I didn't want to look like I was posing as that. So I just kept my mouth shut, and I just, it burst out of me in February. So I didn't plan on it being celebratory or anything. It just was a snap judgment, a poor snap judgment on Twitter, where I just said exactly how I felt. And it was exactly how I felt in the moment. And it was tricky. It was wild to see the way that people spoke about it, because there was a guy who's like one of the big board members of GLAAD. And I believe he's the Labour advisor on LGBTQ issues, maybe Anthony something. He tweeted that he was in Hollywood right now, and he can confirm my sexuality is actually just straight. And I was like,
oh my god,
what?
How the fuck?
How dare he?
I think eventually after he was then very warm, I don't remember what happened, but I think he got into a lot of trouble for that, because that's a wild thing to say.
Yeah.
And I think he got told off by the board of GLAAD. But imagine working for GLAAD and then gaslighting someone around their sexuality with this false information. It's like, who are you talking to my vagina in Hollywood? Like, who are you consulting?
I love that. I'm in Hollywood and I can say for a fact, this is so ridiculous.
Like an outside broadcast.
I can confirm I'm with her vagina, and
we're now live with the vagina.
It was insane. So that was, it was tricky. It definitely made me very reserved when filming, because we were filming in the middle of all of this going on.
Oh,
so
God.
I became like the dog from The Artist on the show, which I'm sure was only
smiling.
Further, like just silent and nodding. And I think that's probably further perpetuated the idea that I don't deserve to be that.
See, straight.
Oh my God. I was so reserved on the show, but I think it'll be better next season. Oh. I feel much more comfortable. And I've been treated so well by the members of Ballroom on the show, who I asked if I should leave this season. And they were like, "You're not. I will drag you back by your hair." So they have made me feel properly like part of the family, and I'm just honoured to be a part of it. And I feel nothing but positive vibes now.
Well, I'm sorry that had to happen to you. And, you know, it's amazing that you did it, because visibility, as you know, is like, it's incredible. And that kids can look up and see you and go, I'm like that, you know, because there's such a lack of visibility of queer South Asians, you know. As you know, you obviously know this, but it's just incredible to see.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I had an amazing response from young South Asians who are queer, who felt safe to come out to me in my DMs. So it was very beautiful, as well as just a bit tricky. And I could have handled the whole situation better. My inability to recognize up until truly maybe this year or that moment that I have to be more careful when I speak has also added to this.
That is maybe the case in this instance, but you always seem to be so thoughtful about all the things you've said about speaking up for young girls and the imagery and the, you know, the lollipops, the flat tummy things, and the way that I love that thing you say about the double patriarchy, double agent. And I just think you're a very thoughtful and you're measured in what you say, and you understand what value you can have when you say it, and then you also don't just blab it, you make organizations up and follow through. So I mean if you have one little slip, I think don't whip yourself.
I don't whip myself too much, but I do also recognize that, like, I should have worked out earlier. I am 34. Like, I should have worked out earlier that when I am saying these important things, or things that are around hugely nuanced and historically complicated issues, don't do it where you are confined to 280 fucking characters. What the fuck was I doing? When I speak in a podcast or in like on stage or in an essay form, I can actually convey my entire thoughts on something, whereas you skim everything when you are talking, when you're trying to talk to millions of people in something that can go viral so fast, where you are devoid of context, tone, where they can't hear your intonation, they can't tell when you're tongue-in-cheek or when you're not. And because you are a woman who speaks out, there is naturally a mistrust of you that dates all the way back to bloody Adam and Eve, where we put the most sinister intention behind an outspoken woman's words and actions.
Totally.
All of them. If you go back through history, every single woman who stepped outside of her box, evil, manipulative, liar, overly promiscuous, quote unquote, you know, just every stereotype exists.
Nasty. So,
I didn't understand the system and I spoke on Twitter like an asshole.
Well, I don't know about you listeners, but I'm having a bloody lovely time listening to this. So this is the end of part one. Go to your feed and find part two. Click play and enjoy more of the delightful Jameela Jamil.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Powered by Spirit Studios.